ever wish for a safe place to have conversations that need to be had? A place where you could say the things that need to be said? Well, welcome to Hope for Med.
This is Hope for Med, Med, new day for Med, Med, for us, by us, and just for us. This is Hope for Med, Med, this is Hope for Med, Med, new day for Med, Med, for us, by us, and just for us. This is Hope for Med, Med.
Welcome back to the Hope for Med podcast hosted by me, Dr. JB. Hope for Med was created to instill hope for a brighter future for us as healthcare professionals and to ignite change. Every movement starts with an awareness of the issues. We need to talk about it because it needs to stay in the forefront of our minds and of our hearts. We need to have those difficult conversations. We need to face the truth, the ugly truth, then act on it. Not sweep it back under the rug because it's hard, because the solutions aren't clear-cut. Let me give you an example. When a patient presents to the emergency department and is unresponsive, there are a multitude of things that could be going on with that patient. There is a real possibility that if I do not act, that patient may die. Do you see a similarity between us and that patient? Our death as healthcare professionals can occur both figuratively or literally. Figuratively meaning leaving the profession. In those situations, we can reincarnate ourselves into another career path, healthcare related or not. Literally meaning death. Do you know a healthcare professional who has died by suicide? It is an overwhelming situation to figure out what is going on with an unresponsive patient, especially when I have no collateral. He or she was found down or dropped off, and that person or persons who dropped them off went to, quote, park the car, end quote, and never came back. Well, in that situation, I throw everything I have at that patient and see what sticks, collecting data and acting in real time, knowing what may work for one unresponsive patient may not necessarily work for the other. One could be a drug overdose. One could be hypoglycemic. One could be severely acidotic. One could have an intracranial hemorrhage, to name a few. The first assessment always begins with a pulse check. We have assessed the pulse of the healthcare system. It's there. Not great. Thready. Trying to keep the essential organs alive, providing just enough oxygen to keep them functioning for one more day at a time, but not enough to handle a fight or flight situation. So we need to intervene. We need to not only talk about the issues, but find what will strengthen the heart, what will allow for blood pressure to be recorded, then to strengthen it more, to normalize the vital signs, then strengthen the body, transitioning from the bed to a chair, then from the chair to standing, then walking, to running, sprinting even. Do you follow me? Can you see it? Is it possible? Hope for Med is not this idealistic company not grounded in the reality of the situation. We are clearly grounded because we live it. Nor is Hope for Med under the pretense that with the snap of our fingers, suddenly, overnight, things will miraculously get better. It takes time. Real, lasting change takes both time and effort. But it needs to start somewhere. It needs to start sometime. So, why not today? Are you ready for real, lasting change? COVID-19 showed us as healthcare professionals that fluidity on a national and even international scale is possible in healthcare. We can change. We can evolve. We don't need to continue doing things like we always have done them because that's just the way things are done. If the way things are done is ineffective, creates more harm than good, then why keep doing it? There's harm to the patient and harm to the healthcare professional. Healthcare is not a career that you stumble upon. Oh, I couldn't do anything else, so I decided to become a healthcare professional. That has never been the narrative. If that happened to be your narrative, you wouldn't last a week. There are so many sacrifices that you endure to become a healthcare professional. It's truly a calling. So much so that for those of us who transition out and get reincarnated, the vast majority stay close to healthcare. What is the harm that we experience as healthcare professionals? First is loss of our idealism, which, truth be told, is merited. I entered healthcare very idealistic. None of my patients would ever die. I'd know just what to do to save their lives each and every time. My eyes were wide, my smile was vibrant, and my tail was real bushy. I was ready. Then I realized that regardless of what treatment I give a particular patient, the outcome may still be the same. I cannot save everyone. My patients will die. Why? Because death is a part of life. It's a part that I needed to accept. And that made me grounded in reality and less idealistic. My thinking changed to, I'm going to do my best by every patient, and if, despite that, death remains on the horizon, then I'm going to have those tough discussions with the patient and the family and provide comfort. That's the natural progression of transitioning from idealistic thinking to realism. However, I wouldn't consider that example as experiencing harm. The harm we experience as healthcare professionals is the moral injury we experience day in and day out that slowly tears us apart, causing us to become disillusioned and burnt out. Truthfully, I was taken aback to learn that some healthcare professionals don't like the word burnt out. They take it as a personal insult, like they couldn't handle things, couldn't handle being a healthcare professional, so they got, quote, burnt out. Personally, that's how I feel about the word resiliency. Ugh. Those of you who have brought that word up in conversation with me got an earful. That word creates a visceral response in me, and I become like a mother bear. Don't talk to me about resiliency. Don't tell me I'm not resilient or my colleagues aren't resilient. We are some of the most resilient people on the planet. How many hoops did we have to jump through to get to where we are? How many times did we fall on our buttocks, then stand up and do it again? In my mind's eye, resiliency, unlike burnout, is a personal attack. The World Health Organization defines burnout as an occupational phenomenon and not a medical condition. If this is an occupational phenomenon, why is it a personal problem or failure? It's a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. Who is supposed to be managing this chronic workplace stress? The healthcare professional? Their managers? The C-suite? The payers? The government? Who? And burnout is characterized by three dimensions. One, feelings of energy, depletion, and exhaustion. Two, increased mental distance from one's job or feelings of negativism or cynicism related to one's job. And three, reduced professional efficacy. Again, how is this an individual shortcoming? The fact that you became exhausted and depleted of energy working in an environment of chronic stress that's poorly managed? Or maybe it's the cynicism and negativism and the depersonalization that occurs working under chronic workplace stress that's poorly managed. For me, that's a self-preservation technique. It's about survival in an environment where your needs are not acknowledged and your voice isn't heard or listened to. No, it must be this one. Reduce professional efficacy. Yep, that's the issue of the individual healthcare professional. Why can't you be more efficacious? That's easy to say when you take things out of context. But we won't take things out of context here at Hope for Med. How am I to come up with individualized care plans for you based on your personal socioeconomic status when I'm under the gun to meet my metrics? When am I able to really connect and strengthen the patient-provider bond when I barely have time to reconcile your medication list? I have a checklist of things I need to complete from my documentation to get paid for my services and a waiting room full of patients to see. How is that my personal problem again? It sounds like a systems issue to me. According to W. Edward Demings, who is arguably the greatest quality and systems guru ever, 94% of the results we experience in the workplace, both good or poor, are a function of the systems and processes in which people work, not the efforts of people. So again, I ask, how is burnout the individual person's issue? Moral injury, on the other hand, is an individualized process. The universal code of ethics for healthcare professionals is, first, do no harm. When we are unable to provide our patients with optimal care, is that equivalent to harm? When we diagnose someone with, say, cancer, then send them out with no follow-up, just a recommendation to establish care with a primary care physician who can, at some later point, refer you to an oncologist who can, at some later point, order you a biopsy, who can, at some later point, talk with you about treatment options that are thousands of dollars. Is that harm? Oh, I forgot to mention, you don't have insurance? Well, then I guess first you must figure out how to get insurance, then go down the path outlined above. Is that harm? Moral distress was first conceptualized in 1984 by philosopher Andrew Jamton in his book entitled Nursing Practice, The Medical Issues, to describe the psychological conflict nurses experience during ethical dilemmas. In it, he wrote, "Moral distress arises when one knows the right thing to do, but institutional constraints make it nearly impossible to pursue the right course of action." Then, in the 1990s, the term moral injury was coined by psychiatrist Jonathan Shea and colleagues based upon numerous narratives presented by military or veteran patients given their perception of injustice because of leadership malpractice. Their definition had three components. One, betrayal of what is morally right. Two, by someone who holds legitimate authority. And three, in a high-stakes situation. In 2009, the term moral injury was modified by Brett Litz and colleagues as, quote, perpetuating, failing to prevent, or bearing witness to acts that transgress deeply held moral beliefs and expectations, end quote. It focuses on symptoms related to guilt, shame, anger, and disgust. When applied to our day-to-day experiences as healthcare professionals working in this dysfunctional healthcare system, it can be viewed as the challenge of knowing what care patients need, but being unable to provide it due to constraints that are beyond our control. But what happened to the patient being central? What happened to first do no harm? Each time we are made to make these choices, to choose anything over the best interests of our patients, it injures us, makes us disillusioned. Each of those nicks pushes us closer to burnout. So, is it moral injury or burnout? For me, it's both. Sustained moral distress, you know, these moral dilemmas we have with almost every patient encounter, results in moral injury. And as healthcare professionals, we experience moral injury almost daily. Burnout is not a derogatory term. It's the reality of working in a system with no regards for the best interests of the healthcare professionals in it, nor the patient it supposedly serves. It's on us as healthcare professionals to refocus our priorities back to where they should be, the patient. The health of our patients and the health of our nations. As the ones providing the care, let's make sure our wellness is optimized so we can fulfill our oath of doing no harm to our patients, because that's where our loyalty lies. I maintain hope in my fellow healthcare professionals that are at the bedside and experiencing these moral injuries to say, enough is enough. The needs of patients need to be central, not the pockets of stakeholders. That's the only way to combat moral injury and increase career longevity.
Yeah. Who says a doc can't rap? D-O-C-T-O-R-J-B, the greatest doctor to ever touch the mic, the greatest podcast ever broadcasted or pre-recorded. Come learn some. Each one teach one. I'm done.